Hello and welcome to episode 42. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. And starting with this week's industrial roundup, and in particular with community health, where bargaining continues. This week we're meeting with the allied health professionals to continue negotiations for a replacement agreement. This work is being conducted alongside the work of the Community Health Working Group, which has been developing a counter-proposal to the log of claims developed by not only the allied health professional unions, but a number of the other unions that have made claims for community health. With respect to our health service members, this week sees us continue bargaining for the replacement agreements for doctors on Tuesday and Thursday, as well as a meeting with the HRIR managers on Wednesday. That will be followed by a meeting of the overarching reference group, which continues the work to go through the implementation issues arising from last year's agreements. Also this week, we have a meeting with respect to dental therapists, and we have a tentative meeting scheduled for the first time for the statewide classification committee. For those members who are not aware, all applications and outcomes for the statewide classification committee will be posted under the statewide classification committee group that you'll find on the VHAA app. That way members can keep up to date with regards to the activities of that group. Just a reminder that there will be a podcast quiz to close out the end of the year where your knowledge will be tested. That's all for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. And joining me for this week's discussion is the Manager of Workplace Relations Services and part-time hand model, Tim Nagle. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks, Stuart. Good to be here.
Tim, would you do the honours and reveal the clue which will indicate the subject for this week's discussion?
Sure.
So for the benefit of those who are listening rather than watching this podcast, could you describe the object?
It's a hand tambourine.
I think the technical term for that device is a hamburine. And on the basis of that clue, what's the subject for our discussion today?
Handy people classification structures.
Timmy couldn't be more wrong. The hand symbolises something that we are doing that is handy. But in this case, it's the development of something that we hope will give a hand to members in applying a particular clause. And we're talking about user notes that we've developed, and user notes in particular that have been developed in consultation with respect to the family violence leave provisions of our enterprise agreements.
Excellent. So what are the user notes? What are they?
So these are additional materials that are intended to explain in greater depth the way in which a particular clause operates. And we're trying to focus in particular on clauses that have either been substantially rewritten or have been introduced into the sector for the first time, which is why we're focusing on user notes for family violence leave.
Okay. And what are user notes not?
They're not a policy framework. They're not a complete guide to the subject matter. They are an explanation of the clause and the industrial obligations.
So if members are in the process of developing a framework to deal with this issue, are there materials available to them?
There are. And there are two sets of materials I think that members should be particularly aware of. There are some policy framework materials that have been developed by a group that included a number of VHAA members. And the website address or the web link is something that you'll find in the user notes themselves on page 2. So you can access that policy framework if your organisation has not yet developed that policy framework. The second lot of materials that people should be aware of are materials developed by the Royal Women's Hospital. They have published all their written materials in support of their policy framework on part of their website. And again, the web link for access to those materials can be found on page 2 of the user notes. Mm. So don't rely on the user notes as your be-all and end-all with regards to family violence. There's a lot of other work that can be done and is available, and you'll find the links in the user guide, in the user notes itself.
And how are the user notes developed?
So it's taken us about 6 months to get to this point, and what we sought to do is consult broadly. We did that, for example, through our regional forums, but we then also consulted with various unions as well as our overarching reference group.
And for those who aren't familiar with what the overarching reference group is, who are they?
So the overarching reference group is a group of VHA members who volunteer to participate in that group. It's kind of like a super EBA reference group. Mm. It has responsibility with respect to implementation issues that span various agreements, and they also have responsibility for working on implementation issues that are referred to them by other reference groups.
So we met with the reference group and they assisted. What was after that?
So certainly, look, the reference group was particularly important, as well as consulting with members, because what we were seeking to do is draw expertise from our sector to make the user notes as effective as we could. But after that, we actually convened a meeting of all health unions to go through the draft user notes with them.
Yeah, and was it a productive process then?
Look, it was. And previously, we'd reported a little bit about our experience last year, where we had brought the health unions together and the results were a little bit mixed. On this occasion, it was quite useful. And I think what it says to me is that there is a need to meet with all the health unions as a group from time to time to talk about those issues that do span across agreements. Mm. So for me, it was both informative and a productive process.
And so as a result of that process, were the user notes an agreed document?
So in terms of the user notes, we haven't sought agreement across the spectrum from all the different unions. We have sought their input, and we've been really able to accommodate almost all of their feedback. But with a written document, it's always difficult to seek agreement from multiple parties, and you may never reach agreement if you seek to do that. So I think it's fairer to characterise the user notes as something over which we have consulted with the unions about, and consultation in the classic sense, in that their input has had an impact on the end outcome.
Yeah. And so how are the user notes set out in terms of...
Yeah, so the way the user notes are set out, after an index, there's an introduction. And then there are various items, numbered items. And each item corresponds, states which subclause that it relates to. Okay. So we have these clauses in our various agreement, but the structure is the same. So when we talk about a subclause, it will correspond across the agreements.
So there's a structure that's linked to the structure within the agreement. In terms of there's a section on purpose, what's the purpose of the purpose?
The purpose of the purpose is really just to remind people to be purposive. The purpose and the reason for identifying that up front and the reason for including that in the introduction is really just as a way of setting the scene.
Yeah.
And it's important with a clause like this to talk about purpose. What we're trying to achieve is that the clause operates as everybody wants it to and expects it to, that it succeeds. And that's what success is, that it operates as intended. And the reason for identifying purpose as being the correct starting point is that we don't want people to apply any clause of any agreement in a trite or a narrow or a pedantic sense, but to actually consider about how to apply the clause, having regard for its purpose. And so it's really just about setting the scene. It's particularly important with this entitlement.
It gives context.
Very much so, and it really is trying to say this is the approach that you should take to applying and interpreting this clause.
So the other part is the introduction as well that you just mentioned. What's the what does the introduction do other than what you've talked about?
Yeah, look, just also in terms of setting the scene, it provides a reminder to members that family violence events are not solely something that happens externally. Family violence events can occur within the workplace through a number of means, such as email, such as telephone calls. Because of the nature of the industry in which we work, simply by people presenting to the workplace as such. So it's just a reminder that these aren't things that happen outside the walls. They are also things that can occur inside the workplace, and it's necessary to have regard for those risks.
Anything else in the introduction?
Just one more thing. Under subclause 4G of the Family Violence Leave Clause, there's a reference to the development by an employer of a guideline. The user notes are not your guideline. That is a different document. So a guideline is a document that will identify who is responsible for what actions in your particular workplace. Having a clear set of identified responsibilities and people who have accepted those responsibilities is crucial to making the clause work. That's what the guideline is. People should still develop that to make sure the clause operates. The user notes are really just about explaining the clause.
So that sounds like an important point in that the user guide is one thing, but there's still another piece of work that health services need to do.
There are several pieces of work, of which developing guidelines is one.
Yeah. So leaving the, that's the introduction. What does Section 1 of the user guide do?
So Section 1, that first item, it talks about not only subsection 1 of the clause, but also some words that appear just below the heading and before subsection 1 even begins. And the note at the top of the clause makes reference to the definition of a family member and makes the point that Section 8 of the Victorian Family Violence Protection Act has a broader definition of family member. And it's really just to alert people to that fact.
And why is it necessary to point that out?
Within industrial relations, what we're accustomed to is the term immediate family. The term immediate family is one that's defined in all of our agreements, but it's also defined under the Fair Work Act. That's what we're used to. And it's appropriate to emphasise that we're talking about something that is broader than that. And what the user notes do is provide that additional detail so people have that to hand and don't have to go looking for Section 8 of the Family Violence Protection Act.
So the answer is in the user notes.
That's correct. So the term family member, that includes all the obvious things that you would expect that term to cover, such as the person's current or former spouse or domestic partner, but it also includes a range of other people. Someone who has or who has had, that is the past tense, has had an intimate personal relationship with that person, a person who is or who has been a relative, a child who normally or regularly resides with the relevant person or used to reside with a child of the person. I'm just making the point that they may no longer be a child at that point, who has an intimate relationship with that person.
So having regard to the G rating of this podcast, what is an intimate relationship in terms of the clause?
Yeah, so I think it's really just about making sure that people don't make an assumption as to what it means. So the term under the Family Violence Act is quite broad. It's clear that it may or may not be a sexual relationship, for example.
What else does the definition of family member cover?
It also covers a person who is regarded as being like a family member, whom it's reasonable to regard as being a family member, having regard to a whole range of circumstances. And those circumstances include things such as these social and emotional ties, whether they live together in a home environment, the reputation of the relationship in the relevant community, the cultural recognition of the relationship in the relevant community, duration, financial independence, care and responsibilities, or the provision of support. The reason for including that level of detail within the user notes is that it's going to take people beyond the boundaries of what they might assume to be a family member. And I think it's really essential that people are alert to the fact that it is a broader definition.
Yeah, so Section 1 really deals with the breadth of the what's considered a family member. How about Section 2? What does that focus on?
Yeah, so that the second section of the user notes correlates with subclause 1B of the family violence leave provisions, and it goes to the issue of the availability of leave. Specifically, what that subclause in the family violence leave clauses provide is that leave for family violence purposes is available to employees who are experiencing family violence to allow them to be absent from the workplace to attend counselling appointments, medical appointments, legal proceedings, or appointments with a legal practitioner, and other activities related to and as a consequence of family violence. What the user notes do is go into greater detail with regards to the last part of that sentence, that is, other activities related to and as a consequence of family violence.
So what does other activities related to and as a consequence of family violence actually mean?
Firstly, what it means is that the term is not exhaustively defined. It's not a set menu of activities. The key thing to consider is the connection. It might be a health issue, it might be a childcare issue, it might be a housing issue, and still fall within the scope of the clause. The user notes also make the point that the occurrence of family violence and the activity that is a consequence of family violence might occur at different times. That is, there might be a gap between the event of family violence and the activity that is a result of the occurrence.
How so?
To take an example, such as a court appointment. A court appointment might be separated by some time from when the actual event occurred, but it is still a consequence of family violence.
So that's section two. That brings us to section three. What does that contain?
So section three of the user notes goes to the clause, goes to subclause three, and that talks about paid leave for family violence purposes is available to all employees with the exception of casual employees. And it goes to the issue of family violence purposes and that expression, family violence purposes.
And what does family violence purposes mean?
Again, it's a broad term, but you should be looking at subclause 5 of your family violence leave clause, which we'll get to in a moment, but that provides additional information about that entitlement to paid leave.
And how about casuals?
Casuals don't have an entitlement to paid leave, but they do have an entitlement to unpaid leave.
So that brings us to subclause 4. That talks about evidence, doesn't it?
Yeah, so subclause 4, and if you go to section 4 of the user notes, it extracts the relevant provision with regards to evidence. And the first thing to note with regards to evidence is that it may be required. It doesn't have to be required. And where it is required, it can be in the form of an agreed document issued by the police, court, registered health practitioner, family violence support service, district nurse, maternal and child health nurse or lawyer. And a signed statutory declaration can also be offered as evidence.
Sorry?
Which is one of the common questions that people ask. Can a stat deck suffice? Mm. And the answer to that is, well, yes, it can.
And the other question that we've got is, what is an agreed document?
Yeah, and it's a really great question. The term agreed document appears in the clause, but it's not defined. Obviously, it does include those things that are included within the clause and the agreements. I think what we're talking about is evidence that would satisfy a reasonable person. And people should come to the issue of evidence through that lens and consider whether the evidence would satisfy a reasonable person. Another way to look at it, would it satisfy a third party? Mm. If there was a dispute and it went before the commission, would the commission be satisfied? One of the examples, though, that we have expressly included within the user notes tries to capture perhaps what might be the most common form of evidence, such as and that's a family violence safety notice that's issued by the police. We've suggested that employees should be encouraged, though, to exclude the part of that notice that details the nature of the violence.
So there's a level of redaction may be appropriate?
Yeah, so it's not addressed in the clause, but just in terms of its application, redaction of some information may be entirely appropriate. The purpose of the evidence is to be satisfied that there is a legitimate basis to the entitlement under the agreement. The purpose of the evidence is not to trawl through personal information.
Mm. So subclause 4B refers to a requirement to keep personal information confidential. What's this involve?
Yeah, so subclause 4B does have that requirement. And if you go to item 5, section 5 of the user notes, what we talk about is what might constitute personal information. Mm. It's personal information concerning family violence. Employers keep personal information with regards to their employees, but it's about that connection. We've also extracted the definition of personal information from the Privacy and Data Protection Act 2014 as an example. In effect, when you need to make a record, you should think about doing that in a way and in a manner whereby the identity of the employee is not apparent and cannot be reasonably ascertained.
So how is that possible?
It may be as simple as utilising an employee number, for example.
So what about confidentiality?
So the first principle with regards to confidentiality, and again this is set out in the user notes, is confidentiality is really about ensuring that people who know about the issue, that it's on a need to know rather than want to know kind of basis. And when it comes to the issue of who needs to know, that is something that should be determined in consultation with the affected employee.
I note that subclause 4 prohibits adverse action against employees if their attendance or performance suffers at work as a result of experiencing family violence.
Yes, I'll take you to item 6, or section 6 of the user notes. The term adverse action is one that we are familiar with within people and culture and HR and IR in the context of the Fair Work Act. It has a particular meaning. But it means something slightly, doesn't have that strict legal meaning here. When we talk about adverse action, we're talking about ensuring that somebody is not disciplined or terminated as a result, in effect as a result of family violence as such. So this goes to one of the key objectives of the clause, which is set out at the front. One of the reasons for having family violence provisions and family violence leave is to ensure security of employment for those who are experiencing family violence.
So so an employer can't do anything in those circumstances?
Not quite. It's an employer should take reasonable action to ensure safety for patients, safety for the employee, safety for other employees. It doesn't operate to prevent supportive measures. Together with a contact officer, there could be discussions about how to support improvements.
So I think the important point there is still about maintaining employment and not taking that adverse action that may threaten the employment.
And it's because the matters that are at issue, such as attendance or performance, are connected to the family violence.
And what does the user guide say about contact officers?
So that comes out of subclause 4D of the agreements and item 7 of the user notes. And there are some action items effectively for employers, such as identifying the family violence contact officers within the workplace.
That's who the contact officers are?
Correct. And the training the contact officers receive, those people must then receive training, both with regards to family violence issues, but also with regards to privacy issues.
So it's privacy as well?
That's correct.
Where is that training available?
So people are starting to develop family violence contact officer training, and it seems to be that there are providers who are operating within the space, including some women's health services and family violence services. I think one of the bits of unfinished business for me, and this became apparent when we spoke to the unions, is what is the accessible family violence contact officer training that people can tap into, and that doesn't seem to have been developed across the board and may not be available across the board. So I think that's a gap that we still need to fill. But the user notes also include the things that should be part of that training.
So the contact officers are identified, trained, and then what?
Advertised. People need to know who the family violence contact officer is, and that can occur and should occur through multiple formats. Notice boards, intranet, internal newsletters, policy. I think it should be something that's addressed in induction.
Do the user notes talk about how to establish contact officers?
So there are a few suggestions. One of those suggestions is that more than one family violence contact officer should be established. One of the queries that we've already received, you don't need 24-hour coverage. It's not like an acute service. What you're trying to ensure, though, is that there are no barriers to access in place. So if you have only one, then it could be that there is a reason why the person experiencing family violence doesn't feel comfortable going to that particular contact officer. So you need alternatives. It's also the case, from what we've said in the user notes, is that the family violence contact officer should be appropriate. That could be culturally appropriate in a diverse work environment, and it should also be gender appropriate. Oftentimes, the contact officer will be someone in HR or include someone in HR. But if your HR person is a bloke, that won't be enough because that potentially could be a barrier to access, and that's what we're trying to avoid.
So your contact officer arrangements really have to have regard to ensuring there aren't any barriers to accessing?
That's correct.
So this begs the obvious question. What does a family violence contact officer do?
In a sense, it's important to begin with what they don't do. So a family violence contact officer is not there to fix family violence. They're not counsellors. They're not case managers. There are other people that have those very specific skills. So the family violence contact is to help the employee get the support they're entitled to under the clause of the agreement and to make the clause operate. And it's worth keeping in mind that a family violence contact officer may also require some level of support because these are difficult issues.
So one of the questions that we do get from time to time is not necessarily the role of the person experiencing the family violence or the contact officer. It's about those other people within the environment, such as the immediate supervisor or also the union delegate. What's their role?
Yeah, so subclause 4E of the Family Violence Leave provisions talk about the immediate supervisor and union delegate as other pathways through which this issue might be raised. In a sense, they're both logical points of first contact.
So does that impact upon how supervisors are trained?
It will need to. So those people will need to know how to handle those kinds of inquiries, both in terms of the family violence principles, but also confidentiality. But regardless of who the first point of contact is, the organisation must have very clear lines of responsibility to ensure that what must be done gets done.
And what kind of responsibilities do you think would be apparent?
Yeah, so we've set these out in the user notes, and they're things such as who's responsible for liaising with payroll, who can authorise, who's delegated to authorise the payment of leave, who's responsible for ensuring that the issue is managed in a manner that's consistent with the agreement, who's responsible for ensuring that where family violence leave is taken, the confidentiality is preserved on rosters and payslips, responsible for ensuring that the employee is fully informed of the entitlements under the clause, ensuring that those who need to know do know, responsible for ensuring that a workplace plan has been considered or developed or implemented.
What do you mean by a workplace plan?
So it's within the clause itself. Effectively, it's actions at the workplace level that are intended to provide a safe work environment. That could be a change of hours. It could be a change in email address. It could be a change in phone number or a safe work location. It could be a range of things, but it's considering how these can be done and what needs to be done to provide a safe work environment. That's the purpose of that plan.
So we talked about paid leave before, and you've also talked about the roster and the pay slip. And so obviously the issue there is how it's recorded. What would we say about recording family violence leave on the timesheet and the pay slip?
So this is where the benefit of the expertise from both unions but also the overarching reference group and members comes in, because some people have developed their ideas quite fully. So what we've suggested under the user notes, first of all, it can't be expressed as being for family violence leave. That would breach confidentiality, but after consulting with members and unions, we think it should be marked as personal leave or similar.
Why personal leave?
So people can access personal leave for a range of reasons, and not just because the employee themselves is sick. So if someone is fit and healthy one day and absent due to personal leave the next day, there's nothing incongruous with regards to that. It explains why the employee is absent. It also supports consideration of backfill. It's got to be noted that in the context of family violence leave, that it can fall into a couple of categories. Some of it will be planned leave. And a court appearance might be an example of that. But some of it will be unplanned and unknown at the time.
The role of payroll seems critical.
Yeah, it is. And what's necessary is to ensure that there is some intervention to make sure that if it's marked as personal leave on a roster, for example, that it's not deducted as personal leave. The entitlement under the clause is to 20 days or up to 20 days. That's not an accrual. It's available in each year. So what it does, and this is where the lines of responsibility are clear, who's responsible for ensuring that intervention from payroll to ensure that the family violence leave is paid and that personal leave is not deducted.
And how about the pay slip? What are the considerations there?
So it's got to be remembered that a partner who is potentially the perpetrator of the family violence may have access to the pay slip. So it can't appear as family violence leave on the pay slip either. We've suggested in the user notes, having regard for the collective wisdom around the table, that ordinary hours other or some similar designation be given. It is important that we are able to get a sense of how broadly the leave entitlement has been used.
Mm. What about someone who is supporting another person who's experiencing family leave?
So we get a lot of questions about the role of someone who's supporting someone else. The first thing to note is that there's long been an entitlement to utilise carer's leave in certain circumstances. That is that you can utilise carer's leave to provide care or support to a member of the immediate family or household who experiences an unexpected emergency, for example. And one of the ironies has been that you can provide care and support to someone else because of a family violence emergency, but there wasn't an entitlement for leave for yourself if you were the person experiencing it. What the new family violence leave clause does is it still makes the point, if you're caring or supporting someone else, that's personal leave. But what it does do is it broadens the use of that provision. So it's broader than a member of the immediate family or household. It could include a friend or a neighbour. That is, the effect of that clause is to broaden the access to personal leave if you're supporting someone else.
Mm. So you mentioned a workplace plan before. Is there an obligation on employers to consider requests from employees to change their arrangements?
Yeah, there is. So the user notes go into this, but it's subclause 6A of the Family Violence Leave Clause. It says an employer will approve any reasonable request to vary their conditions, such as changing shifts, duties, location, telephone number, email address. It may be that the parties consider something like a flexible work arrangement, if that is useful. So what the user notes are seeking to do is to remind and encourage employers to think more broadly. You may need to, for example, amend your website if you ordinarily publish the contact details on your health service or community health service website. It may well be that you need to restrict the publication of things like phone numbers or restrict access even in terms of the switchboard in some situations. What it's asking people to do and reminding people to do is just think it through.
Hmm. And would those changes be permanent?
Generally not. Changes should be temporary with reviews at agreed intervals. The objective should be that things return to normal once things return to normal.
And should employees that are experiencing family violence also be referred to the EAP?
Yes, they should. But in the user notes, we've suggested that employers check with their EAP providers to ensure that the people that they are supplying to give support have been trained in family violence issues. My sense is that if your EAP provider hasn't gone through that process and doesn't have those kind of people, that they soon will.
And where can people find the user guide?
So we'll be putting it on the app, but also posting it on the website, and we'll provide some information to members as to how they can access those user notes once they're published.
To recap, what would be the key points?
So the user notes are intended to serve a purpose, and that purpose is to help members get their head around a completely new provision. That's the purpose of the user notes. So those are the things we want people to keep in mind. But Tim, thank you for joining me today to talk about our user notes.
Thank you, Stuart.
And I think we should say thanks to the Hanbury.